Now, leading off today's program on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Kerry Cantrell, the coordinator of the Northwest Intersex Action League, based here in Portland. They discuss intersex, people born with multiple different variations of male and female urogenital structures. They discuss her experience from birth as an intersex person, how after being deceived for many years and undergoing a lot of pain, she discovered the truth about herself and found commitment and peace in social activism.
Kerry Cantrell, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill, for having me. Glad to be here.
Kerry Cantrell is the coordinator, organizer. What are your other titles in the NWIL?
There are so many things that I do with the Northwest Intersex Action League. I network, I direct politically, I coordinate with other organizations. So I'm just going to say organizer slash mother figure.
Kerry Cantrell, tell us about intersexuality. The goals of the NWIL, why intersex people need organize like all historically subordinated peoples. We can consider how the control and discipline around sexuality contributes to the authority and class structures of the overall societies. Let's just start with intersexuality, and maybe you can tell your story.
So thank you. Thanks for inviting me to come in here and speak. Well, okay, yeah, we'll just start off with my little bit of my story as an intersex person. I was born with diverse characteristics. These days, there have been so many gender expressions, sexual expressions, sexual identities. We call it the alphabet soup these days. And back in the 80s when I was born, you know, there wasn't no alphabet soup. There was just four letters to represent sexual minorities, LGBTQ. Intersex is an umbrella term, basically. There's a term called didactic reproductive development. And that basically means that there's two forms of reproductive branches that can shape a child's development, whether you're being born as a typical female with XX chromosomes and you develop ovaries, you develop birth canals and et cetera, secondary sex characteristics, or you develop along the lines of an XY male, where you develop testes, scrotal sacs, semen production to fertilize females, etc. Intersex people can be a combination or a retraction of any sort of important sexual reproductive quality that didactic folks can produce on their own and develop on their own. So, for example, my personal intersex variation is called androgen insensitivity syndrome. And androgen insensitivity syndrome means that my sex chromosomes are XY. Typically, you would find in XY development what we would call a didactic male reproductive system. But because of my insensitivity to the same hormone, which is a catalyst for male development, androgen, my body does not respond to the male hormones and male development signals that same XY people get. So instead of developing scrotum, penis, semen production, all that stuff, my body developed in a very unique intersex way. Because of that unique development, there are physical manifestations on the outside of the body. There are internal organ production that are unique to intersex people. All of these beautiful characteristics are medicalized by our community at birth. Because
they're very noticeable, often very noticeable. Sometimes they aren't. They sort of develop later, right? But
sometimes they're not. But the thing with intersex characteristics is that they're only really noticeable by your doctor and your parents when you're a child. We live in this culture where people determine the sex of your child and how to treat you as a child by asking what sex you are, by asking what gender you are. Are you having a boy or a girl? Are you a boy or a girl?
They look at that right away, right?
Your parents, yeah, exactly. When an intersex child is born, your parents and your doctors are really the only ones who have that first insider information. Is it going to be a boy or a girl? And so when you're born with ambiguous characteristics that cannot determinedly tell a group of people or society if this child is going to be a boy or a girl, they tend to make that decision for you. And so that can result in early traumatizing surgeries for infants that have zero consent about what they're being subjected to. And there's also not really any consent on the parent side as well.
The doctors push it. The surgeons
push it. The doctors
push it.
The surgeons push it. The medical community pushes it.
In fact, it's a good profit center, right? Those surgeries are very expensive and covered by insurance.
Covered by insurance. And not only that, but this manufactured dependency on the medical industrial complex has lasted me and will continue to last me for my entire life. Because of these surgeries, they removed internal organs that were unique to my intersex development. They removed internal organs that are responsible for hormone production. Because of that, I now suffer from osteoporosis, advanced osteoporosis in my hips and lower lumbar. I need bone treatments. I need this and that to stave off early menopause symptoms and things like that. Not only that, but I've had to be irrevocably tied to false synthesized hormonal interventions my entire life, starting in puberty to kickstart my adolescent puberty. And throughout my adult development, I've kind of taken the reins back into what hormones I will be taking and what regimen I'll be on. But I do still am required to take hormones for the rest of my life or until probably menopausal age if I'd like to maintain a healthy body development and a healthy body function.
You had surgeries through your whole life and hormonal treatments through your whole life. We were talking earlier. You pointed out that for the first 26 years, you never met another intersex person.
No.
You were basically presenting as female, right?
Correct.
In school, in high school, yes. Everywhere, you're presenting as female.
Here's the thing, Bill. I was forcibly assigned female at birth. My androgynous characteristics at the age of 4 days old were altered cosmetically on a newborn infant. I went in for surgery again at 18 months old to further solidify my parents' and the doctor's decisions to assign me female. This is when they removed my organs. This is when there was deeper cosmetic surgery on my genitalia as an infant. Basically, it was beginning stages of a sexual reassignment surgery. And so this is the assigned identity that I was given. Throughout my developmental years as a toddler and young child, throughout school, before puberty, I was fed an extremely sort of, I wouldn't even say it's sucrose. I'd say it's bland, like having oatmeal for breakfast. Like very, very, very basic knowledge of what my scars were and where they came from. My parents were extremely insistent on reinforcing my role as a female and their daughter, even though as a child, and I know a lot of people take their gender expression as a child to new heights of importance these days, but it's part of the social reinforcement that we can talk about in this conversation of what gender roles are and how they come to oppress people. But as part of my oppression, very typical female roles were rigidly enforced on me starting from a young age. And I believe that is because my parents, in the back of their mind, knew that they had given a sexual reassignment surgery to their child, and they wanted to validate that decision as much as possible. So they wanted to see me behaving as a female. They wanted to see me enjoying my body and my experience as a female because they had made that decision for me, supposedly in my best interest, based on the doctor's information, which was false and manufactured. So that's...
Could you operate, though, as a female in your teen years? And
operate in what way?
I mean, you know, with men having romantic relationships of any kind or close relationships or intimacies of any kind?
Unfortunately, it was very hard for me to develop trust with other people. Not only, okay, so the surgeries I mentioned were only the first couple in a series. The last surgery I was subjected to was after adolescent pubescent age. Throughout puberty, my hormone regimen, my psychotherapy, my sort of social conditioning was ramped up throughout high school, which caused, to answer your question, no, I didn't date in high school because I was extremely nervous the entire time after being told a big pot of lies my entire childhood about who I was. Going through puberty with my friends, lying about whether or not I got my period, whether or not I was dating this boy, whether or not I was doing this and that. My friends were going to their OBGYNs for the first time, and I was being taken to endocrinologists and psychotherapists to reinforce my assigned gender, falsely. And so I was constantly making up stories about who I was and what I was doing there because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. Every effort and every step taken from people who were meant to be in my life as caretakers, doctors, my parents, my family, you know, they didn't reinforce my identity. They didn't reinforce like who I was as a person. They dragged me around to different offices across the state of North Carolina to give me more medical interventions, whether it was in the form of psychology or chemical or even more surgery, which is at the end of my high school career. It was when I had that last surgery, which is basically... The last surgery I received was the final step of a sexual reassignment surgery. It had to do with colonoscopies and all these really complicated things. But basically, my sexual history before college consists of making stuff up and going to doctors and being told the narrative that without these interventions, without your conformity to heteronormative behavior, you're not going to be happy. And I'd also like to mention at this point, amongst the slew of doctors, you know, you asked me if I had ever known any other intersex people. I probably went to hundreds of doctors since I was a baby. Hundreds, lots. Every single medical care professional, from a nurse to a triage person to primary care doctors, endocrinologists, surgeons, therapists, really? Every single medical professional I ever interacted with made sure to exclaim how rare and unheard of my condition. They always called it that, my condition. My condition is so unheard of and invisible. And one thing that was always reiterated, underlined, as if it was practiced, was that I was never going to meet another intersex person in my entire life.
So you just have to be satisfied as a female.
You have to be satisfied as a female.
And act like one.
And by the way, you are welcome. You are welcome for this bottle of pills. You are welcome for this surgery. You now have the opportunity to be happy because we fixed you. It was the message I was receiving.
You've been an expensive patient for this society.
Yeah.
The insurance company, of course, paid all of it. I mean,
no, you're quite right. To be perfectly honest, since coming out as an intersex person 2 years ago, by the way, I got to meet more intersex people 2 years ago, medical industrial complex, and now I'm coming for you. But since I got to meet more intersex people 2 years ago at the Androgen Insensitivity and Different Sex Development National Support Group meeting, I've been awoken to the fact about what was actually happening my entire life. I was completely confused in the dark. As a child, as a teenager, even as a young adult, I was heavily, heavily, heavily freaking oppressed. Besides the literal surgeries and medications that I was being fed and subjected to, there was also huge psychological and emotional scarring. You know, I experienced a lot of mistrust for people. I experienced a lot of depression, anxiety, and of course, PTSD from basically being sexually traumatized in the medical setting as an infant. There's lots of genital trauma involved with intersex treatment. There's no respect whatsoever for intersex bodies or children's right to consent to have an adult touch them in extremely private and personal places. None whatsoever. You're treated like a lab rat. You're treated like an exhibition. You know, as a matter of fact, oftentimes I would go in for surgeries or treatments, and if an endocrinologist or a surgeon was teaching rounds or something that day, sometimes there would be interns who would come into the office and watch as they, you know, as they performed an examination on a young minor. And I never consented to any of this. I was an infant. How could I? But anyway,
so this is just normalized, though. You didn't even at the time know it.
Exactly. I was being conditioned. And, you know, I always had obsessions with Law and Order, SVU, and I had no idea why until I became old enough to realize it's because you've been sexually traumatized, Carrie. You're a survivor of sexual traumatization. You've been attacked and oppressed sexually since birth, and your sex as an intersex person has been attacked and oppressed pretty much the beginning of time.
For intersex people, it's most extreme. Mm. But I think probably all sexual minorities find the confusion, the difficulties, the pressures, particularly in their childhood, one of the great things about the gay lesbian revolution is that now in the culture that every kid knows that sexuality is various. Now, some of them deal with it by fearing that they're going to be a homosexual or something different and being angry at them and being vicious. A lot of them, though, now sort of recognize that sexuality is extremely fluid. There are all kinds of sexual expressions, social, some of them based in genetic and developmental biology. Many of them, though, based in just sort of cultural norms and cultural feelings and the way kids grow up and have relationships.
Right, yeah.
But I think it's much more known now. Do intersex kids, how many are there actually that are called intersex? It's a huge range. Some people have various sexual characteristics that...
yeah.
that are ignored, basically. Yeah. I mean, they sort of have other characteristics, but there's a lot of kids born that are somewhat unusual. Right. How many, though, are categorized as intersex and then set up for operations? Although there's some parents now who are not doing it. There's a real movement to stop that.
That's correct.
And
so,
tell us about the numbers and things. Do you have any idea?
I've got a few numbers I can throw out. I know close to 90% of intersex people who are born presenting with androgynous genitalia. And for the sake of this conversation, we're going to say androgyny. We'll just say that it's neither male nor female. And it could either mean a blending or a subtraction of either characteristics specifically. So I don't want to put any David Bowie glam spin on it. I don't want to put any non-binary transgender spin on it. But for the sake of medicalizing myself to utilize this conversation, we'll just call it androgyny. If you're born with androgynous, ambiguous characteristics, almost 90% of people born with ambiguous genitalia, if you're born in an industrialized country, you most likely are going to be either definitely subjected to or at least pushed to be subjected to one gender or another. It's very, very, very common treatment. And this is based off archaic practices and beliefs and traditions, almost cultural traditions, rested in the binary, a heteronormative white supremacist white binary. As far as numbers, intersex populations are so unstudied. The only practice so far that we can regularly look at is that intersex people are 100% of the time pushed to the margins of society or made into invisible. The topic of our bodies is invisible because it has to deal with such a taboo subject of non-binary. Also, what you have in your underpants is kind of a very sensitive subject in a Puritan-based culture. You know what I mean? And there's no room for that conversation in our society. So obviously, there's no room for intersex people either. So I can tell you that close to 90% of intersex people born with ambiguous characteristics will be assigned female, whether that's assigned surgically, chemically, or just assigned. And then I can also say that my particular intersex variation, which is androgen insensitivity syndrome, is about 1 in 20,000 people born with that particular genetic variation. And intersex, again, is an umbrella term for many different variations that result in a lot of different manifestations of humanity.
There's a lot of people, actually. Basically, we've ended the first interview. We're going to continue. That was Carrie Cantrell, who's the coordinator, organizer, legal counsel, treasurer of the NWIAL, but they're actually organizing. There's a lot of people who are interested, and they're holding meetings and having intersex people meet one another. Carrie Cantrell was talking about the typical development of intersex people, the way it happens, 90%. There's lots and lots of them. No one knows how many. And probably most intersex people in this country who have had all the surgeries and everything live their whole lives as the assigned gender.
Right.
And marry, and I suppose tell people, look, I'll marry you, but I can't have children. I had an early accident or something that. They'll say that. And we can adopt. And my guess is that most of them, through their whole lives, never really tell anybody.
Never really tell anybody. And, Bill, you would be shocked and heartbroken at how many people I've met that themselves never even knew they were intersex because they have been lied to purposefully with manufactured lies about ovarian cancer, urinary tract issues, bladder. I was told, I remember I had some story concocted as a young age about something about peeing. That's all I knew. I had urinary problems. I connected it with my bladder. Down there was all I knew, you know? And once I made contact with people at a national support group and we all got together and had the opportunity to exchange stories, this movement was started by a woman who discovered her intersex identity at mid to late 30s and started tracing back their medical records and looking at what actually was happening. And that wasn't ovarian cancer. That's, you know, going around thinking that you're a cancer survivor is one level of trauma. Cancer, coincidentally, is another way that this medical industrial complex will try and control you and try and scare you into making decisions that are not in your best interest. And that's one of the narratives that are fed to intersex people constantly. If we don't remove your organs, they're going to get cancerous. If we don't operate on you, you're going to get cancerous. If we don't do exploratory surgery, you might have cancer. And so that big C word scares a lot of parents. A lot of parents will make the decision to operate on their child based on a fear of cancer, which has been fed to them by their doctors.
That was Carrie Cantrell, the coordinator, organizer, mother, legal counsel, treasurer, building an organization. There's lots of people interested, and they have a national organization and national people, intersex people. We'll be talking to Carrie again about the significance of intersex activism, along with the activism of so many other sexual minorities, and how important that is actually in contributing to a new sexual morality that's emerging. We'll talk about that as well. It's inevitable, actually, and it's going to happen even during the Trump years. They can't stop it. And it's very, very important because it contributes to the overall hierarchy, class hierarchy, race and gender hierarchy. We'll be talking to Carrie Cantrell again to go into those sort of questions of larger social change. Carrie, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill and Carrie. This is the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You just heard the first part, as Bill said, of a two-part interview with Carrie Cantrell of the Northwest Intersex Action League. In the second part next Monday, Bill and Carrie will address how intersex action and work by other sexual minorities by building knowledge and understandings contributes to changing popular ideas about sexuality and sexual morality.